back, you know, and I'll get them if you have their on. Today we are happy to have Matt Leifert. Matt lives in Sunnyvale in Manchester, then he did the Park Street of Mount Medical Circles. I did the same thing many years before. There was a time where I worked, I think, the hardest of my life. And so that was a peak, and after that, the Park Street is. So I was very impressed that also I did the Park Street. And then he went to work with Noah Island and Bristol. He came to Perimeter as a postdoctoral fellow in January 2004. And we'll talk about quantum logic. But I should also mention that he's organizing a conference, a workshop, in July from the 17th to the 22nd on quantum logic here at Perimeter. If you're interested, please contact him and we'll learn more about it. Thank you, Matt.
Okay. Thanks, Ray. I find for everyone here is my big day. The first thing I want to say is that I haven't come here to sell you my own interpretation of quantum mechanics. I'm sure you're bored with that by now. But instead, I want to talk to you about quantum logic. And it is a topic which I think is very important for the foundations of quantum mechanics, and it gives a lot of insight into various different interpretations. Now, the subject has a reputation of being mathematically very technical. So what I've tried to do in this lecture is present things as simply as I possibly can. And so I'm going to have to skirt over some technical niceties that people normally worry about. So in particular, every time I talk about Hilbert space, or I talk about the set, or anything like that, I'm going to just assume it's finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. I won't necessarily think that explicitly every time it comes up. Okay, so I guess the first question I should answer is, what is quantum logic? The way I want to introduce it is by contrasting the views on quantum mechanics of Feynman and Feynman. Now these are just really views on how the mathematics of quantum theory works. There's no interpretation of quantum theory yet. So Feynman's view was essentially the way we start off is we have some kind of classical theory. Classical theory is a classical set of things you're interested in. It plays classical logic. You can set up a set of theory of samples based and things like that. And so a clear example of that is something like if you're interested in a particle traveling from point A to point B, the set of all possible paths that you can travel from point A to point B, something like that. Now, on such thing, you can set up regular ordinary probability measures. And if you do so, you arrive at the classical probability theory of that particular phenomenon. But there's another thing you can do, which is instead of assigning probabilities, you attach amplitudes to things, complex numbers, okay? And then you arrive at quantum mechanics. Now, Feynman, well, you can find this view in Feynman's lectures on physics, this figure with the double slit experiment in particular. And this view has been very successful. I'd say that it roughly corresponds to the view of a large number of working physicists. And it's been very successful in areas like quantum field theory. Now, on the other hand, von Neumann's view is quite different. Instead of the difference between quantum and classical happening here, it happens at a much earlier stage. So you replace classical theory that you start to work with classical logic, essentially, by something called quantum logic, which we all want to talk about. And then, in order to arrive at either classical probability theory or quantum mechanics, you put probability measures to those things. And you do that in exactly the same way, well, not exactly the same way, but essentially a similar way in both cases. Now, this view has also been very successful. So the current view that we have of quantum measure theory, for instance, is essentially all based on this kind of view of quantum mechanics. And it is a particularly interesting view to take, I think, from the point of view of the interpretation of quantum mechanics. Now, in some other lectures, a lot has been made of the interpretation of probability. Okay. So there are some interpretations seem to entail that you view probability one way or another way. And as we've heard many times, the interpretation of probability, even in the classical case, is very poorly supported. That's not entirely resolved. On this view, however, probability arises in exactly the same way quantumly and classically. And so therefore, hopefully, you can start to talk about what are the conceptual issues with quantum mechanics independently of any issues to do with probability. Hopefully, any old interpretation of probability that you can get to work will work in this case. And really, all of the difficult issues arise over here. And so if you get nothing else out of this lecture, this is the picture I want you to go away with. Okay, so here's an outline of what I'm going to talk about. So first of all, I'm going to have to introduce some mathematically technical things. So this will actually take quite a large portion of the talk. And we need to get there in order to talk about the interpretational issues. There are three central topics where this comes up in interpretations that I want to talk about. And probably there's only going to be time to cover two of them. The first one is quantum logic has been used quite extensively in that analysis of different possible hidden variable theories you can have. And we heard in one of the very early lectures about the Delft perspective theorem, quantum contextuality. And that actually originally arose in the context of quantum logical analysis. It came out of that approach. And I want to kind of put that in context here somewhat. Now, the next thing is probably the most radical view you can take from quantum logic. It's basically, if you take quantum logic fairly seriously as a real logic of the world, then you arrive at something that I'm calling quantum logical interpretation. This is pretty much a full play interpretation of quantum mechanics. And the person who first proposed it, or the person who proposed the most well-developed version, was a philosopher of science called Hilary Putnam. This view has come in for an awful lot of criticism. In particular, he claimed that he had a realist interpretation of quantum mechanics, and there's been a lot of debate about whether this really constitutes realism. So I want to touch on that debate a bit. If there's time, I suspect there won't be, I'll talk about operational quantum logic, which is a much less radical view. It basically says quantum logic can happily coexist with ordinary regular classical logic, and then people who take this view tend to try and derive the structure of quantum space, quantum mechanics, from some logical principle. And this area is where it really starts to get quite mathematical. But those kind of derivations are similar in spirit, if not in detail, to the kind of thing that you see in the film you have 2 days ago. Okay, so now, first of all, I have to start off with classical logic before we can understand quantum logic. So is there anybody here who's never heard anything at all about classical logic? Well, I'm not going to assume very much, but I have to present things in a certain way in order to connect up with the lots of things. So first of all, what is logic all about? Well, as you probably know, logic is basically the study of valid forms of reasoning. It's the study of valid arguments, valid proofs, and things like that. In order to study such things, you have to develop a kind of formal language. Okay? You're not going to study these things in the context of English language, say. So you develop a formal language of logic in order to study these things. And it essentially consists of two parts. There's a syntax that tells you how to perform sentences in the language. It tells you essentially, you know, what sentences in the language are. And the second part is semantics, which is equally important, and this tells you how to attach meaning to these sentences that you form. How do they adapt to the world? How to set up it for walls, things like that. So these are the things we're going to look at. So I'm going to restrict attention today to propositional logic. It's really the simplest type of logic, and it's all we'll need. And the basic objects of propositional logic are the propositions. Okay, so I'm going to label those by letters A to B. And these are supposed to stand for basic statements that you can make, things like, you know, Waterloo is in Canada, crops are green, trees are raining. Those are all examples of basic propositions. So now we need a way of forming more complicated propositions, more complicated sentences from these basic ones. And the way that's done is by using these logical negative operators. They informally stand for not, and, or, if, then, and, in, and earlier. And they have formal names, negation, conjunction, disjunction, information, and equality. So then that's everything there is in our language. Now we need a couple of rules for how to say what the sentences of the language are. Okay. So there are only really two rules of this logic. First of all, and by the way, you're defining everything with a cursor before. So we say that if A is a sentence, then not A is a sentence. And if A and B are sentences, then A and B are sentences. And there are also some rules which are quite cumbersome to explain when the same case are added or removed for emphases, but probably follow that around. Now you might wonder what happens to the other logical letters. Well, you don't actually need to apply the syntax to them because they can actually be defined in terms of the and we've got negatives. Maybe this is unfamiliar to anyone.
And you don't say groups?
Well, yeah, in the context of classical computing, right, you know that and then what must be universal sort of gates. So of course they have the more of a okay, so here's an example of compound proposition. So if I associate A, this is raining, B is in water, is in Canada, and C is in crops are green, then I can write that sentence like this, and I can decompose it using these definitions into just ends and dots. So some of you may be wondering if this is the simplest form I can write it in. You may know, for instance, that not A should be the same as A, for instance. Now, at the moment, as we define different syntax, we don't know that yet. So we have to look at the semantics of logic in order to figure out what the equivalences are between the propositions. So, any questions about syntax? Okay, so probably most people will be familiar with truth table semantics of propositional logic. Has there anyone who hasn't seen truth table before? No. Okay. So, you know, as you know, you assign truth value to 1 or 0 to every proposition, whether or false. And you have tables for how to assign values to the compound propositions, the layered values of the basic propositions. And you can build up tables for more complicated propositions like the one in the last slide by proposing these rules. Now, unfortunately, this is not going to work at all when we move to the quantum case. So we're going to have to look at something completely different. Okay. And this may be where it starts to get a little bit complicated. Okay, so the semantics I want to look at is the set theoretical semantics of the propositional logic. So now instead of associating propositions to truth values, we're going to associate them to sets, mathematical sets. And they're just going to be associated to the set of objects for which the proposition is true. So here are some simple examples of that. The object is green, it's associated to a set that contains everything. You know, you can look at the screen, frogs, grass, emeralds, leaves, etc., etc. Proposition like if it's raining, well, we may be only interested in a particular week. If we're interested in a particular week, we might decide to associate the set of days in which it rains, which would be Monday, Tuesday, and Friday. And a particularly important example, and one we've actually heard about several times in this course, is propositions of the form, some physical system has a value of a physical quantity in some particular range. That's sort of the most generic proposition that I want to make about a physical system. And in classical physics, I'm used to make physics associated to a set of phase data points, right? So you can make phase space where the system of particles consists of their positions and their momentum. And any statements about physical quantities must be some region. These are the kind of propositions that we're really going to be interested in the quantum case. Okay. Now, it's convenient to introduce a couple of other things. First of all, something called a universal set. Now, as you might imagine, dealing with sets of everything that you can possibly imagine that's three could be quite complicated. So usually you get a restricted domain of discourse, and you put in a universal set all the things that you could possibly be interested in talking about. But in our case, these are always going to be finite sets, so we'll restrict ourselves to talking about finite things. And of course, there's the empty set, which consists of no elements as well. Okay, so now we need to say how sets going to be associated to compound propositions. And I'm going to introduce some notation here, which is these square brackets. And that stands for whatever mathematical object I associate to a proposition under the semantics we're using. So in this case, it's going to be just sets. When we move to the quantum case, that'll mean something different. But for now, it just means the set associated to the proposition. Okay, so the negation, that just corresponds to the set theoretic complement, okay? So it's everything that isn't in the set associated with proposition A, but is in the universal set. Then there's conjunction at hand that is associated with set theoretic intersection, right? So it's all relative to the set associated with proposition A and the set associated with proposition B. And then finally, we have disjunction, which corresponds to union of sets. So that's everything that's either in A or in B or in both of them. So this is a simple example. Okay, suppose this is the universal set we're interested in. These are the things we're interested in talking about. The proposition, the object is green, in this case, it's just associated to the set frogs, grass, and hooks, and leaves. The proposition, the object is an amphibious animal, is associated to frogs and goldfish. And then the negation of A is associated with everything that was in this set that isn't in this set. So all the non-green things are here. Induction is associated to the things that are in both these sets. In this case, it's just frogs. And disjunction is associated with things that are either in the set or in the set. So it's a bit. Okay, so up till now I've been talking about concrete propositions, ones that correspond to sentences, to particular sentences. Now I want to talk about propositions in the abstract a bit. Okay, so I want to talk about proposition A. I don't necessarily know what sentence in English it corresponds to, so I don't necessarily know what subset, what set it corresponds to. And there are many possible ways of assigning a proposition to a set. If I give you a universal set and just a set of abstract propositions, they could cross off any odd subset. And so you can think of any way of associating them with one. And so here are some definitions. You say that propositions are topology. If it's always equal to the universal set, if it's always something of the universal set under any possible assignment. An example of something like that is A or not A. Okay, that's sometimes called the law of the supremum minimum. The contradiction is always assigned to the empty set, so you can never find any objects that satisfy it. An example of that is something like A and not A. Okay. And finally, I'm going to say that two propositions are equivalent if under any possible assignment, they're always assigned to the same set. And here are some of well-known examples of different purposes. Okay, so there's one obligation that I talked about earlier, there's the force laws, and there's the distributed laws. And these are the ones that I want you to pay attention to at the moment, because it turns out these are going to hold going into quantum bits, distributed laws there. And that basically says that A and B or C are the same as A and B or A and C. Okay. And that doesn't work at all. Okay. So now I have to introduce, so basically, that's all you need to know about classical logic. But it's helpful to introduce some more technical mathematics. So the next couple of slides are going to seem a little bit technical. And you may not know why I'm doing this, but after, as soon as I've done it, we'll see how it makes up a little bit more about the logic. Okay, now let's talk about closed sets, partially ordered sets, and lattices. Okay, so let's deal with closed sets first. So a partially ordered set is just a set, any old set, and it has a relation to phi on it. It's actually only a partial relation to phi, so it needs some relation. And it has the following properties, right? So if A is always less than or equal to A, any element. If A is less than or equal to B, and B is less than or equal to A, then that's the same as saying A is equal to B. And finally, if A is less than or equal to B, and B is less than or equal to C, then A is less than or equal to C. Okay. So those are the defining properties of the partially ordered set. And, you know some familiar examples of this, right? So, for example, the real numbers, when you interpret this thing as usually less than or equal to sign, is an example of partial order. Actually, that's a total order. Because the difference in a partial order, okay, if you have a total order, then any two elements of the set are related according to this relation. And the difference with a partial order is that there may be two elements that aren't related at all according to this. So these examples up here will help illustrate what I'm talking about. So if I have a finite partial ordered set, or with a finite number of elements, and then I can draw diagrams of the partially ordered set like this. These are called Hassel diagrams. And for each element of the set, I draw a black circle. And those elements that are greater than higher up in the ordering, they go into other things, appear higher in the diagram than other ones. Okay. And they're connected by a line at each level if the ordering relation is true. So in this case, what we have is we have an element C here, that's greater than A. C is also greater than B, but A and B are on the same level here, and they're actually incomparable, right? So it's not the case that A is greater than B, or B is greater than A. So, any questions about that? So we also introduce some other concepts. So if I take two elements of a partial ordered set, I'll say they have a drawing on the least upper bound. If there is an element, I'm using the same symbol for the disjunction there for reasons that you'll see later. If there's an element A drawing B, it satisfies the following properties. Informally, what that means is that it's an element that's greater than A and greater than B, and there's no other element that's greater than both A and B and is smaller than A. Okay? So this example of partially ordered set illustrates that. Okay, you have B here and C here, and you have two elements, F and E, which are bigger than both B and C. This one's the least upper bound, okay, because if I chose F, then E would be smaller than it and still bigger than B and C. Is that clear? And you define a meet or greatest lower bound in exactly in that analogous way. Okay, so it's an element that's smaller than two elements, and there's no other element between. So in this case, you know that this is the greatest lower bound of the meet. Okay, so that's partially ordered sets. And now, we can talk about lattices. Now, a lattice It's just a partially altered set where every pair of elements has a need or a join. Okay. So in these examples here, this element is that element. They only have needs or a join because there's no element that's greater than both and smaller than both. Not final. But in a lattice, that's not the case. And it also requires that there's a greatest element of 1, which is larger than everything else, and the smallest element 0, which is smaller than everything else. Okay. Sometimes that's technically called the bounded lattice of those two things. And I'll define a relation of an atom, which are those are the elements for which only a smaller element is 0 element. Okay. So in this lattice, these two are the atoms. In this lattice, these three are the atoms. And this lattice here is the
So, is that clear for everybody what the lattice is? Yeah. Could you have atoms higher up into those other ones, or zero above it? Does that make sense?
Well, an atom basically has to be directly connected to zero. Okay, that's
what the way. Okay. Is that possible to have two zeros?
No, the zero and one element is supposed to be unique.
Oh, it's a... Is it part of the definition, or is it going to be implied from the previous definition?
It's essentially part of the definition.
Oh, okay.
Maybe there are different ways of defining lattices, and in some ways you can prove it, and in other ways you can just push it. That's great. Okay, let's see how this connects up to the classical logic I was talking about. Okay, so now I want you to consider the logic that just consists of propositions that we can make out n elementary propositions. So I'll label them A1 to AN. So I have n elementary propositions. And you can think about a sort of canonical way of associating sets to these. I'm going to use sets of integers. It's not actually important that they're integers at all. I just associate each proposition with a number. For example, it's only one number. Okay, each of the basic elementary propositions corresponds to a single element set like that. And then my universal set is obviously going to be the set of the first n integers. And every proposition I can make now corresponds to some subset of this. And in fact, it's fairly easy to see that you can get any subset of this set in this way. But it's also the case that sometimes we'll opt for the fact that every set there's more than one proposition that corresponds to it. And they don't necessarily approve of the propositions either. So here's an example of that. In this case, font A1 is associated to this set, and so is A2 or A3 or A4 on the way to A1. Now, what the result of this is that you get something called a Boolean lattice. Okay. So the subsets associated to propositions, they're the elements of my lattice. And there's partial ordering, which is given by subsets for free. Okay, so if something's a subset of another subset, then it's less than, you say it's less than, or even less than, sorry. You also have braced merged elements. So you have the empty set, that's the subset of actually the empty one. Okay. And the universal set, everything is a subset of the universal set, so it's the largest one. And your meat is given by set and set, and the blue is given by you. So here are some pictures of these things. There we have the one element of the Boolean algebra. Okay, so there's only two elements. There's the empty set, and there's the one element set, which is, in this case, just the universal set. Here's the two acts of the Boolean algebra. Okay, so here we have two integers. They're both subsets of the universal set, but they're equivalent to each other. Here's the example with 3 axes, and here's the example with 4 axes. Okay, so similarly, on the same points. Now, underneath the Hassel diagrams, I've also drawn these things which are the breaching diagrams. Now, they're not very useful until we get to quantum logic. Okay. What this diagram means is I draw the atoms of the lattice, and if they are in a common Boolean algebra, common Boolean lattice, then I make them in a straight line. So of course the reaching diagrams of the classical Boolean lattices are reaching, which just makes a straight line. it has many answers. Right, okay, so that's it for class. Any questions about the classical stuff? Yes.
I'm just thinking of formal systems, like instead of axioms, what would represent axioms in like this system that exists?
Okay, well, okay, so I completely disregarded formal logic entirely because, well, it's not really relevant for what I want to say about formal logic. It's going to it for me to take too long. And of course, yes, you're right, there are formal systems of logic where you have a basic system of axioms and state rules of production and so forth. And you can hook that up with semantics and all this kind of stuff, but I don't really want to get into it. Okay, so now what do we want to do for the fix? Okay, well, the basic idea with quantum logic is that the syntax of quantum logic is going to be exactly the same as what I described before. The set of sentences is the same, except for the fact that I'm not going to define the simplification of this equality. Because there are some very difficult technical issues that come up with that. So we're just going to restrict ourselves to the end or what we want. So what we're interested in doing is assigning some kind of meaning, i.e. coming up with semantics for statements about quantum systems. Okay? So here's a basic proposition you can make out of quantum systems, something like the momentum of a particle is between V and V plus V. Okay? Now, on the orthodox interpretation of quantum mechanics, you're told that this statement is meaningless unless you happen to be in an appropriate eigenstate of the system. Okay? If your state is an eigenstate of momentum, then this has meaning, it's either true or false of the system. Okay? If you're in an eigenstate of position, say, but in this statement it's supposed to be completely meaningless. There's no way that you should be uttering it and you should give up your career as a theoretical physicist and insist on doing this. So even worse than that is a statement like this. The position of the particle is between x and x plus dx and the momentum is between p and p plus dp. Okay? Now, according to the orthodox interpretation, this is always a completely and utterly meaningless thing to say if the particles don't have positional momentum at the same time. Nevertheless, if you just look at these things as sentences, they seem fairly innocent. And so, what we're going to try to do in quantum logic is find a way of attaching meanings to these things, and we're just going to ignore the orthodox interpretation. So if anybody actually has an orthodox school was there, that's closing the doors, then maybe they're going to hate this. But I suspect that after hearing about all the other interpretations, you may be able to realize it. So we need semantics for these propositions. We need some way of associating mathematical objects to them. We need some way of determining when they're true or false and these type of things. And here, I don't want to do very much damage to the quantum formalism. Okay? This is kind of a minimal way of doing things. I don't want to start accusing hidden variables. And of course, you know, Bayesian mechanics or something like that, they have a specific meaning that they attach to sentences like this, which is different from the one I'm going to talk about today. So two requirements that you might want is to respect the eigenvalue eigenstate thing. So I said before that there are some cases where this statement is supposed to be meaningful in quantum theory. You want to retain that if you possibly can. And also you might expect that you want to write a broader classical set theories where things when your propositions are about classical observables. Okay. Right, so what kind of objects are we going to associate with these propositions? Well, let's consider an observable, just an arbitrary observable. We know it has a spectral decomposition, it has eigenvalues, and these are the projectors onto the corresponding eigenstates. And the projectors are pairwise orthogonal, and if you square all of them, you get back the projector again. And they sum to the identity. Okay. Now, you know that if the state is like a state, and in this case, states are like a state play, you essentially want to respect the eigenvalue of the state. And you know that the probability assigned to a particular outcome plus the probability assigned to the predictor is given by this formula. And it's either 1 or 0. It's 0 if this isn't the eigenstate that you're in, and it's 1 if J equals K. We're talking about the eigenstate you actually are. So it seems natural. These things are a bit like truth values, right? They're 0 or 1. So it seems natural that you might want to associate propositions now with these projection operators. And equivalently to that, you can associate them with the subspaces. The subspaces of the building space, these projectors project onto. And it's a little bit more convenient to describe these in terms of subspaces than it is in terms of projection operators. So, I will switch between the two later a bit, but for now we're going to talk about subspaces. Okay, so basically that tells me how to hook up subspaces to basic propositions, and we now need a way of forming the subspaces that correspond to compound propositions. So now I'm going to use this square bracket again, and this denotes the subspace that corresponds to the proposition. And I'm going to use this notation for the projector of that subspace. So again, respecting the eigenvalue eigenstate, you essentially have to choose the orthogonal subspace to represent propagation. So that's everything in the Hilbert space, such that for all the states in the original subspace, you're in a product of them in 0. Okay. That's how you're going to represent propagation. And you can check that subspace. In terms of projectors, this is just the affinity operator minus the projector of A. Conjunction and operation is going to work in exactly the same way as it does in the classical case. We don't have any need to modify it, because it turns out if you take an intersection of two subspaces, for all the vectors that either lie in one subspace that lie both in one subspace and in the other subspace, that's still a subspace. Okay. You can still take arbitrary superpositions and you don't violate its condition. That's a bit more difficult to define in terms of projectors, but here it is, and you can check with us. Now, this junction, here's where things get really very different from classical logic. Now, I could try to associate this with the set theoretical union of the two subspaces. So I could try to just associate it with vectors that are either in A or in B, or in both. But that's not a subspace, okay? Because I can take a superposition of vectors of a vector in A and a vector in B, and that wouldn't be in that subspace. So this is sort of the minimal subspace you could think of associated with this junction, what you call the linear span. So it just means that it's all vectors in the Hilbert space, such that there's a vector in A and a vector in B that you can always get a superposition. So similarly to the way we did in classical logic, you can define a tautology, contradiction, and equivalence in the equivalence. So a tautology is just any proposition that corresponds to the whole Hilbert space, or it corresponds to the identity operator. Contradictions are ones which are always associated to the null subspace, so that's the subspace that contains no vectors at all. And equivalence is defined as propositions which are always associated to the same subspace under any transport cycle. So this again forms a lattice as before, okay? And now there's a partial ordering which is essentially the same as the partial ordering in the classical case. So if A is subspace of B, subspace associated with A is subspace, and subspace associated with B, then this satisfies the partial order relation in the sense of projectors at least in this situation. So maybe it'll help to illustrate this with a couple of examples. Okay, so here's basically the simplest non-trivial example of this measure. So you have, imagine we have a real three-dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, so I can just draw it to the plane like this. And And I have a pair of basis vectors, or one of the basis vectors, which I can take on as the Z off spin and Z down spin. And I'll say there's a proposition A which is associated with this subspace. Now this subspace is the entire line. And the subspace associated with this negation is again the entire line. And of course, if I take the disjunction for these two things, then that's any vector, essentially contains any vector that corrects the superposition of this guy and this guy. And it's got the entire Hilbert space. Similarly, I can do the same thing with lower parent vectors. Let's say these ones represent X and then the proposition by B. Okay, they generate the entire Hilbert space. So essentially, by disjunction, sorry. So essentially, you can understand this part of the lattice here. This is just the ordinary two-element Boolean lattice. And again, here, this is a lower property of the Boolean lattice. But you can also do things which you're instructed what to do by the lots of notation. Talk about things like X up and Z down, or X up and Z up, or those kind of things. And again, if you take the disjunction, if you take all of A and B, for instance, then that's any vector that can be written in terms of a superposition of epsilon and zeta, which is again the entire Hilbert space. So you can look at all the different propositions you can make, and you end up with a structure like this. So as I said, it's like two Boolean lattices, and they're pasted together at the 1 and the 0 element. So of course, one's the entire Hilbert space and all sorts of things. So now the Grecian diagram is a little bit more than trivial. I have two entirely separate Boolean elements. So everyone's separate. Okay, so now here things begin to get a bit more trivial. Now I'm going to talk about 3D real Hilbert space. And things become quite difficult to draw accurately in this case. So here, the vector associated to A is supposed to be pointing up, and all the other vectors here are supposed to be in the plane or the north. And basically, I choose two different decompositions of the identity, both of which contain A. So I have three vectors like that, and that's my rotation like that. Okay, so I have the black pair there on top, or I have the red pair there on top. And now, if I take the disjunction of two things, then I, instead of ending up with the entire Hilbert space, I just end up with a plane. And I can form all these different planes by doing that. And if I take the disjunction of three distinct things, then I end up with the entire Hilbert space again. So the structure you end up getting looks a bit like this. And this one's slightly more trivial than the last one, because now both of the Boolean algebras contain the element plane. So I have essentially two copies of the Boolean algebra again. And they're, instead of being just pasted together at 0 and 1, they're also pasted together at 2 other elements here again. So there's a two-dimensional plane that's common, and there's a one-dimensional vector. And the Grecian diagram looks like this. It's just two Boolean algebras.
And you must think that in such a three-dimensional linear space, all directions are equal. And somehow here you distinguish A, you can draw between the spaces and so on.
Well, I'm just saying that, I mean, this is not, obviously, there are many different lattices you can do in the linear space in different way. I'm just like, this is just one concrete example. This thing would be, if A is in any direction you want. There's nothing special about this vector A.
If you look at this graph, how it is special because it's different than
It's special because it happens to be common to both those two vectors. But if you consider all of the subspaces of the space, right, so now I can show you that quantum logic doesn't obey that it's distributed by derivatives. So I'm just going to use this two-dimensional example here. And I'm going to try and apply a distributed by derivatives to three elements, so A, B, and not B. Okay. This is what the left-hand side of the distributed by derivatives will look like, and this is what the right-hand side looks like. So now, if I take B or not B, okay, those are two orthogonal vectors, and they generate the entire Hilbert space. So this just is just the entire whole source, the largest element of lattice. And if I take the junction of element A, well, that's just the intersection of that line across what it's A for the entire orbit space, which is just again the line, the rip line across what it's A. On the other hand, here, I'm taking the conjunction of two incompatible things and A. The conjunction basically corresponds to the largest element, the greatest upper bound, greatest lower bound on A and B. Okay, so it's the element that is smaller than the wavelength, but bigger than anything else that's smaller than the wavelength. Here, it's just zero. It's just the lower bound points. The same is true for A and not B. So they get zero, disjunction with zero, and that's again just the lower bound. So this is different from that, so it's confusing to see. Now there are a couple of other, there are a couple of technical conditions which are kind of weakening the distributivity. And people who work with the theory of quantum logic, they place a lot of importance on these things. So instead of studying distributed lattices, you're studying modular lattices or non-modular lattices. Here I'm not going to use these conditions at all, but just to let you know, these are what the face is distributed. And in fact, this one only applies to finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, and this one applies to all okay, so that's it for quantum logic. So, does everybody understand?
Yeah. Just going back to the other side for a second. Does it break down because you're working in two different Boolean logic cycles, I think?
Yeah, because in quantum logic, I allow myself to take junctions and disjunctions of things that aren't the same Boolean element. Okay, and you have to do that in order to see it break down.
Yes. I was just wondering why we don't define the implication. Put it just equal to the, you know, the nuts of A and not B, not goes on.
Yeah, so you can define an implication like that, but of course, in classical logic, there are many other ways of defining it that are equivalent because of the distributive laws. Okay, so I could say something like not A or A and B or something like that. Or maybe that's not what it's called. You could have examples that are equivalent, and they turn out not to be equivalent in the quantum case. And then the question is which one's the most natural conventional? And people have argued about that. You know, the end of the debate is that essentially there isn't the most natural. So that's why it's really difficult. Okay, so I said that probability arises in this view in exactly the same way in the classical and quantum case. So let me explain why that's true. So here's something about the theory of classical probability limits. And again, you know, I'm simplifying by only considering finite examples. In a standard probability theory, you define the probability measure on a subset, on a set of subsets. Equivalently, you can say it's on a set of propositions, so you can say it's on the Boolean lattice. You can see those pictures essentially equivalent. So the subset contains the case that you're interested in assigning probabilities to. And if you assign a probability to two different things, then you may also be interested in the probability that you assign to one or the other. Okay, so look, we work a probability measure that assigns any subset of our universe set some value between zero and one probability. Okay. And the definition of these things is essentially the ongoing axioms. Say if I take any set, any pairwise disjoint sets, okay, these are sets that have no elements in common. I define a set which is linearly involved in a set contains elements more than it, and you expect the probability measure to be additive. Okay. That's very straightforward. And there are a couple of other requirements. You want to assign an extra set probability zero, and you want to assign, you know, everything to a possible. That's ordinary regular classical. Now in the quantum case, now we want to do a similar thing. Right? So you want to define a measure which takes the projectors from the Hilbert space, or primarily the subspace of the Hilbert space, and gives you a value of 0 and 1. Somewhere between 0 and 1. and we can do exactly the same thing. So that these projectors, so the end projectors, the only set of projectors on the pairwise of the course spaces. Then you can define this projector, which is essentially just a bunch of those things, and you want it to be additive on those, and you want to assign the null subspace 0 and the identity for the entire Hilbert space, you want to assign the null subspace 1. Okay. And this is exactly analogous to what we did with the classification. Now there's a theorem by Andrew Gleason, which is very important. Context, which says the only functions you can find to satisfy all these conditions when you. Sorry, forget about that. I should say the only measures on the full self projectors on the Hilbert space definition breaks the limit of 3 from this form. Okay, and this form should be very familiar to you. The probability assigned to a projector is just the trace of the projector times growth. And growth is just density. And we're used to talking about as density matrix. So positive operates on the case form. So this is a very important theory, right? Because it kind of says that what we've been talking about at the logic of quantum mechanics is a tight structure. Okay? The probabilities that arise. Quantum mechanics are the only probabilities you can conceive of attaching to things. Okay, there aren't any probability measures on the factors of projectors which aren't performed, which aren't figured by some quantum state. So that kind of shows that maybe we're on the right track.
Is there a natural way of extending this to pure analogs?
Yeah, okay, so there have been proofs of. Gleason theorem that maybe like which extend PMBNs is fundamental logic projection. And yes, there is. In fact, it's rather easy to prove Gleason theorem in the case of PMBNs. And it's made by the British, it's supported by those proofs are rather easy. This one by Gleason is very ingenious.
Would you like to comment why the case n equal 2 is written?
I don't know.
Well, you can do it by construction, right? You can actually find the probability measure that is maybe I'm sure you have it. Okay, so now, okay, so is there any questions about that so far? Okay, so now I'm ready to start talking about some aspects of interpretation related to this. So the first thing is quantum logic and hidden variable theories. Now, it's kind of very natural to think that quantum logic may have something to say about hidden variable theories. Why is that? Well, if you have a hidden variable theory, then essentially your hidden variable space, or your complete space of your quantum system, you're going to expect that to obey classical logic and classical probability theory. You want quantum mechanics to somehow emerge because you don't have complete knowledge of these hidden variable states. But really, they're obeying perfectly classical probability theory. So you may have thought, well, now we've shown the logic of quantum mechanics is non-classical, right? So it must be obvious that you can do a contradiction. And, you know, over the years, many people have tried to do this, lots of attempts failed. But the reason that they failed is because quantum logic allows you to say things about incompatible propositions, right? And, of course, there's, as you know, there's no experiment that can measure both position and propensity at the same time. And so there's no reason to, say that the hidden variable state must assign what quantum logic assigns to something like value or position being a certain thing and value of momentum being a certain thing. I don't know if that was clear. Okay. The point is that essentially it's not trivial to use quantum logic to do this. And so, but you can extend the same restrictions of the hidden variable theory. So it means that this is the essentially the Bell-Fox effect theorem that we had about before. So if you impose these requirements of additional requirements in the variable theory, So if you want to say that the complete state of the system, you know, including all hidden variables, uniquely determines the value of the output of any measurements of the observable that you can make. Okay. And the second thing is that you say that the outcome assigned to the observable shouldn't depend on which other compatible observables are measured with it. That's good to look at the reality assumption. Okay. And you can easily show, using what we have now, that that could possibly be true. You can't have a very specific one. And this version was essentially pointed out by Bell. It says that Beeson's theorem, which I showed you at the last slide, essentially shows straight away that these can't be true. So let's look at what that is. Well, the first thing to say is that projection operators, those are permission operators, right? So they're also projection operators are themselves observable. They have eigenvalue 0 and 1. So the fact that we need to determine the outcome of any observable means that there must be an assignment of 0 or 1 to project. Given variables, they have given such an assignment. So this, the second thing in empirical advocacy essentially implies that our assignment of zeros and ones must also have any conditions of being going to be all ones in nature. So that requires a bit of explanation. So first of all, let's talk about empirical advocacy. Well, I'll add to it for a second. So there are many ways I can choose to measure the value of a given object. I can take any observable from which it appears as expected to be proficient. So imagine a projector which points along the arc, which is a soft space point along the arc direction. Okay. That can be measured simultaneously with two other projectors. And the fact that the values aren't supposed to depend on which other observables I'm measuring, and the fact that we know that measurements only ever have one outcome, we do a measurement, we don't get two of the outcomes. It means that for every set of orthogonal projectors, you must assign one of them value 1 and the other's value 2. Okay. And the fact that it doesn't depend how we do the measurement means that if I take this observable, say, and then rotate, so that this projector is still in common, okay, that's another way of measuring this projector, then the value must be the same. And those are essentially implied by these conditions here. So now, what we're looking for is a measure that assigns values 0 and 1 to every single projector and satisfies all these conditions. Well, Beeson's theorem now tells us that the only probability measures that are valid are the ones of this form. And you already know that there's no density operators you can find. There's no quantum state that exists that assigns probability 0 or 1 to every projector. Now, if we have projectors, say, along the z direction, then this row has to be either the z up or the z down state, but then you know that the projector is the x eigenvalue, not the value 0 or 1. So there's just no way of doing that point is straightforward and consistent. Now, maybe more familiar sort of finite versions of this theorem. So you can actually prove this theorem using only a finite number of vectors. And this proof that I'm going to show you here is essentially the same as the one that Joseph presented in the beginning of the course. But it's presented in a very unfamiliar way. Okay? He presents it in terms of values assigned to observables. I'm presenting it in terms of the zeros and ones that he assigned to projects and projection operators. And this very explains if it's worked out like errors and then later finding that I'm really getting simplified here. So here I have sets of orthogonal vectors, and they correspond to one dimensional subspaces, right? So each column is a set of orthogonal vectors. So for each column, I need to assign one of these vectors value 1, and the other three need to be assigned value 0. Okay. Now, some of the vectors appear in more than one column. Okay. So this one appears here, okay. And the value that I assign them shouldn't depend on what column is in. So if I decide to assign this value 1, then I also have to assign this value 1 and this value 1. Okay. Now, it's very straightforward to see that this can't possibly be done. Because I have 11 columns, that means 11 of these, one vector in each column has to be a solving value 1. So there should be 11 ones in this solving value. But each of these vectors appears an even number of times in the table. You can check that. So however I assign it ones and zeros, I'm always going to end up with an even number of ones. But I want it to have a number of ones because I have 11 columns. So it must be an impossible number. So that's another way of seeing the problem perspective. I want to sort of briefly talk about what this means in terms of quantum logic. So let's forget that this was something to do with invariable theories. And just think, what does this mean quantum logic? Okay, so at the moment I want you to think of these as statements in classical logic. Okay. I can express the statements that one of these things is assigned truth value 1 and the others are assigned truth value 0 as a logical statement. Okay. So this is a statement that basically says there are four things, one of them is true, but the other three are false. Okay. So it's either the case the first one's true, or the other three are false, or it's the case the second one's true, and the other three are false, etc. And I'm associating a letter to a different letter to the different vectors that I'm getting here. So it's using the different abstract models. So A corresponds to the second. And so the second proposition which corresponds to the second follow. I have the propositions A and B and follow in common, right? We can put the same vector. And the other two are different vectors, so they're so I can do that for each of the letter columns if get a logical statement. And then I take a conjunction for those things. So they all have to be true at the same time. A1, A2, and A3. And classically, that's a contradiction. That's essentially what the perspective theorem says about this logical statement. It's a contradiction, and it says that. There's no assignment of ones and zeros that satisfies this theorem. Now, let's look at this, say that this is actually a quantum proposition. So these are now to be interpreted as the quantum definitions of negation, conjunction, disjunction, all of that. And I need to assign subspaces to these things. And it turns out that if I assign these subspaces to these one-dimensional subspaces, then I'll end up with something that's the entire Hilbert space. If this thing is basically true, then it satisfies all the correct or formalized definitions. So I came from something that was classically a contradiction, something that's satisfied by quantum logic. It means that there's the assignment of the density state gives you the entire Hilbert space. So it will be true whatever state the quantum system is in. So that's kind of interesting. So are there any questions about? Okay, so now I'm going to move on to what's going to be the final topic for me. This is something that's called the quantum logic interpretations. Now, the question is, can we make a four-plane interpretation of quantum logic in the stuff seriously? And there have been a few people who proposed the idea over the years. Putnam is probably the most famous one. And he proposed it in the last one, which was called Is Logic Empiric? Later on, the title was changed to the logic of quantum empiric. So you can find out the framing case. And there's also a book by Gibbons, The Pathways and Paradoxes, which goes into the start of learning in great detail. So if you're interested in it, that's a good place to learn. So this is essentially a summary of the interpretation given by Gibbons. So, how do we interpret quantum mechanics using quantum logic? Well, the first statement is essentially that logic can be empirical. Okay? It can be open to revision in the light of the physical theory by quantum. And this is to be interpreted just in the same sense that we have to change geometry. You can see that geometry is empirical when you look at general relativity. Okay? So, space-time really is curved. It's not just. So you really have to change the idea that our world is linear. So Putnam's saying that logic is like this, exactly the same logic. Now, of course, this is a very thorny philosophical problem again. Now, there are, of course, some philosophers out there who think that classical logic is necessarily true, and there have been very big debates about this. And part of Putnam's goal was actually to show that logic was empirically reasonable. So he wasn't necessarily completely concerned about getting an adequate interpretation of quantum mechanics. He wanted to show that logic was empirical. The second thing is that logic of quantum mechanics is not really logic. Yes.
So by the logic of quantum mechanics, you just mean the quantum logic that you've been presenting thus far.
Yeah, so there are many variants of quantum logic for quantum. This is actually the one that Martin was using as well. They said that the logic of quantum mechanics is not really logic. Essentially, the central point is that distributive laws and it says, peculiarities of quantum mechanics are going to arise from illegitimate use of classical logic. And the paradoxes of quantum mechanics are just completely resolved by using quantum logic. Now, I think that Putnam probably considerably overstated this case, so I'm going to back away slightly from some of this claim. It's probably, and the reason is that if you read his paper and you look at it in detail, it turns out that the way he tried to resolve things like the double slit paradox are actually wrong. Okay, he doesn't even use quantum logic for it. It turns out that it's better to say that you can't be formulated in paradox rather than saying they're resolved. That's the space of the world. So again, quantum probabilities are going to present their difficulty. They're going to arise in exactly the same way, my thesis as they go in classical theories, my thesis theory. Nothing of this happening. Yes.
Can you mean by formulating the paradox?
I'll give you an example. I'll actually cover the problem that's going to drop. Why take on the double slit? Okay, and the real big claim, one of the real big claims of quantum logic license is a realist interpretation of quantum mechanics. This is the thing that really attracted a lot of criticism. And it's probably better to say, well, it licenses a certain amount of realism. It licenses realism maybe in the same sense as something like Abraham or Sisyphus interpretation does. It doesn't license a sort of full-blown realism that you have in something like Gomez and Gomez or spontaneous grand series. So this is really what attracts a lot of criticism, so I'll go through that. This also is a fairly controversial statement, and I think that Putnam was probably wrong to say it based on his analysis. This, from my point of view, would essentially entail that all the dealing with is somehow an invariable, right? Some contextual invariable, but then it's a capacity that's going to be. So I also go back away from that statement. Okay, so these two things. So, what I want to do is look at what the fate of realism is. Okay, so why does Putnam say that this license is realism? Well, let's consider an observer. Okay, you can write it in expected decomposition. I'm going to include a zero eigenvalue, which is necessary to do so. Okay, so the projection is a zero eigenspace and zero eigenvalue. And then I can define the proposition as one for each possible eigenvalue, and says the value of A is that being your eigenvalue. Okay. Now, the conjunction of all those propositions, okay, this is a complete orthonormal set of projections basically. And so if you take the disjunction of all of them, you get the entire double space. And the entire double space means something that's true. Okay. So this statement, A1, Y2, all the way up to however many values we have, is always true. But in logic, this statement, when we have a disjunction of some completely exhaustive set of things, that's what we mean by this exists symbol here. So this, if you use the usual logical definition, is equivalent to saying that there exists J, AJ. equivalently, there exists some J such that the value of the observable A is part of J. And that's a realist statement, right? That's some kind of realist statement that says that there really do exist values of the observable in some sense. However, although I can say this statement, I can't point to a particular eigenvalue that the system actually has. Yes.
Could this be because the link between existence and disjunction is one that was made in the 19th century?
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, one possible objection to this whole thing is that you just shouldn't define existence for the first place.
Or at least maybe you shouldn't use the word exist.
Maybe you should, but so part of Hutton's interpretation, of course, was that the logical operators and connectors are interpreted in exactly the same way as the logic is invested. So part of the thesis is that this really is the existence of the world. Of course, you could say, no, maybe it's just called it something else. Or you could say, maybe it's just use classical existence, it means that all of these things is definitely true. That's one possible objection to this. But I guess the problem would say that if you do that, you're just not accepting that there's a logic is the real logic of the world. You're backing away from the state. So I can't point to a particular value that it has unless I haven't been in the appropriate idle state. But nonetheless, I have to say, but there does exist in that. It's a very weird thing to say. Of course, this is non-classical logic we're talking about, so you're going to be in the habit of saying things that appear strange, of course. Now, we can consider exactly the same construction for any logical observables you like. Okay? So, if you see all of the observables of common space that I like, and I can take the conjunction of all of them, all of these statements. So, and this also raises correspondence to the entire logical space. So, I can say, somehow there exists a J such that we have particular values for observable A, and there exists a K such that etc. So in some ways it's not just that observable has value, because in some sense it's always true that all observables have values in some sense. But not really, because the sense that we may have wanted to say is this sense. Okay? You may have wanted to say that there exists a J, and there exists a K, and there exists an N, etc., such that the system has all of these values, this value, and that value, and that value. Okay? But to do that provides a use of distributed ones, of course. Okay? And these things here are always the descriptions of the constitutes area capacity. So it's a very funny kind of realism. And we may say, people of course have criticized it and said, well, this isn't really realism at all, this is just playing with some words. But I'll have something to say about that. Maybe. First of all, let's look at the application to Max Enderberg's version of the probability. Okay, so as you remember from previous discussions to this, if you put in a particle, put in a phase or particle or whatever in this kind of setup in this mode here, then it always comes out to the F. And we would like to say something about which arms of the possible thing. Okay. But it turns out that you can't say, well, you call it normal points of interpretation, you can't say anything about which arm of the possible thing. Somehow it has to get down to the part of something. But what do we say in terms of logic? Okay, well here's how the inference works. Essentially, you put in a particle at A, it goes into a superposition for C and D, and it ends up at F. And instead of talking about F, drop to the particle being here, and get a sort of a whole different to being over here. So it sort of corresponds to this C plus ID. Okay. So F corresponds to this superposition. In quantum logic, we can say that the state F, the state of the particle being here, this is true. Okay? F and C or D is true. So it's true that the particle ends up at F, and it either went through on C or if it's true on C. That's true. So that's, again, kind of weird. It's a pretty good way to warm these up. But of course, the propositions that you ended up for F and you went through part C is a contradiction. Say this one, and say this one. Okay. So it's a, we're stepping back from the four statements. Okay. Yes.
Those legs just go to the back and you didn't see them.
Well, they say it was in C, or you can say that it was either in C or it was in B. But you can't say it was N plus an M and N plus C. You can't say N plus an M and N plus B. So there's any other questions about this? Now, this may seem like a complete trick to you, but actually, one of the things that I think this highlights is that the kind of realism that you had with something like consistent histories interpretation, or that you had in Everett's interpretation, some versions of Everett's interpretation anyway, at least those versions of Everett's interpretation don't meet the many rewards, which that's just the only thing that exists is the way from. They also have this kind of realism. Right? You can say things like, yeah, it's true that one of these things happened, but it doesn't ever give you a unique one thing that actually happens. So in some sense, I think this quantum logic approach highlights the kind of realism that really exists in those interpretations. So if any of you are thinking of taking those seriously, I think that also tells we should be taking this seriously. Now, if you don't like this, then you should do Bayesian mechanics or spontaneous elasticities. Okay, so let's look at some of the objections to this. And of course, there are plenty of them. And to say that we have a fully adequate interpretation in the quantum logic approach would be not true at the moment. But I don't think that the problems are any greater than something we have worked with computational space. So you could say, so one objection I mentioned earlier is that classical logic is necessarily true. But if you think that, then of course we can't take this approach. I don't want to get into the philosophical debates about this. There has been a philosophical debate about this. It's essentially independent of quantum mechanics. People propose that we shouldn't say classical logic is being necessarily true. So there is a way way out of this one, which I don't want to go into detail. So another common objection is that, well, all the propositions about quantum experiments can be phrased perfectly adequately using just ordinary classical logic. So you're claiming that the logic, that the change of logic is entailed empirically, which is true. The experiment hasn't shown us that logic has to change. That would not be true. And the response to this is essentially that, well, quantum logic doesn't have to be the unique way of dealing with things, of course. It just has to be the most elegant one of the symptoms for it, in some sense. You can compare that to the situation in general relativity. You could formulate all general relativity if you like without changing, imagining that the world was really Euclidean. In order to do so, you'd have to introduce all sorts of unlogical forces and things, all sorts of unnatural constraints on what can happen. And there'd be no real way of understanding. And similarly, the statement is here that, at least in the orthodox interpretation, statements such as this position, the particle doesn't have a position, the statement that that's meaningless, that the particle has a position, is somehow supposed to be it's some kind of very unnatural, sort of fictitious thing that you value here in order to understand things in your sort of classical logic framework. Okay, so quantum logic doesn't account for the success of classical logic. Of course, we use classical logic all the time, and it seems to work pretty well. Now, at least the physical, well, in the physical context, you can say classical logic is valid for propositions which are about compatible observables. So if your observables all commute to one another, then you get classical logic. And so for propositions about physical systems, at least, you can argue that most propositions we're interested in everyday life are going to obey classical logic. Now, that's not really a full response to this, because some people say, well, what about the success of quantum logic, classical logic in mathematics, for instance? Right? That doesn't seem to have anything to do with physics. And again, this depends on a lot of philosophy view about what mathematics is really. You know, is it something that really exists independently of us? Is it something we discover, or is it something that we invent? Of course, if it's something that we invent, then it stands to reason that we should use the logic of things that we see around us in order to construct. If it's something that we think is discovered, then maybe we invent it. The first objection I talked about it before is that realism essentially entails the use of classical logic. You're not really being a realist unless you define the existence operator, you know, in a classical way. That there is one of those things that's really true. And so I would agree with that. If you want full realist interpretation along the lines that John Bell would agree with, that really there is a unique reality to pick down quantum formalism, then you need to define the existence of reality in that way. However, I haven't been claiming that it's a realist interpretation of that. It's more of it's like the type of realism that you get to interpret. Is this the history of the world? Now, here's one objection that I think is pretty serious. It says that, okay, you've said that logic is empirical, so it's no way to be using quantum logic, but the meta language used to talk about quantum logic is classical. What the meta language is that's the logic essentially that you use to prove theorems about the logic. Okay? So we can prove theorems about classical, about quantum logic, and we use classical logic to do that. We use the usual rules for empirics that we use there. So, really, you haven't replaced classical logic after all. It's still there, lurking in the background. And so, to say that logic of the world is closer to the end of the world is well, there are two real responses to this. Maybe there's a third one, the first response is to just say, well, look, we've managed to improve on the Copenhagen interpretation at least. In Copenhagen interpretation, we have a split between the quantum and classical worlds. Necessarily a classical part of the world. But they're very vague about what that actually is. They don't say what constitutes a measurement, they don't say which parts of the world are classical, which parts of the world are not. In quantum logic interpretation, you could say that the split occurs in precisely this place. The meta-language is classical, but all statements we make about physical reality are quantum. So you could have a quantum classical split just there. Another possibility is to say, well, you know, this doesn't prove anything, because maybe we could do a lot of quantum logic for mathematics without using any of the classical logic at all. Admittedly, quantum logic people should prove this is true. And in fact, crazy as this may look, there are people who work on quantum mathematics. Yes.
If all the propositions that you've made in defining quantum logic could be presented as commuting observables, haven't you already done it with quantum logic?
I suppose, again, my aim is to show that that's true. And again, maybe these are very hard questions to solve. That was actually the third possibility that I thought of a while ago. Okay. Well, that's any other questions about quantum logic? Okay. So I was going to talk a little bit about operational quantum logic, but since we're running out of time, I won't do that. But what I do want to say about it is that it's this case that problem on minority opinion. It's always been a more popular interpretation among philosophers than it has been among physicists. And not very many people are taking it that seriously. In contrast, operational quantum logic is the mainstream view of people who actually work on quantum logic. and it just sees it as perfectly coexisting with classical logic, and it sees it as just a logical experiment in competitions. I think it's very much into the kind of approach that Lucy was thinking about, where you try to find some reasonable set of principles for which you can write structural principles. And if you want to learn anything more about that, then you can come to the introductory lectures at the virtual conference on the video. So I'm going to say that. Okay, so my conclusion. I want to put this a bit in the context of the interpretations that we've already made about. On my view, when you want to invent quantum mechanics, there are essentially three possible routes you can take. Now, there's the sort of traditional approach, which is anti-realist about quantum systems. So, all of the traditional Copenhagen orthodox interpretations are along these lines, and there are several other variants which take instrumentalism or operations or serious laws and all of that. Okay. Now, the main ferret of realism here, because there are a couple of big problems with this. One is measurement always enters this one unanalyzed primitive rule theory. We are never told what constitutes a measurement, which interactions, which systems are measuring measurement systems. And that could be a big problem if we never want to apply this theory to a case where it's not clear about measurement. About the way functional computers. So even if you're not philosophically inclined, it may eventually be a problem for physics to introduce it in realism. Now on the other extreme, you have what I call full-blooded realist interpretations. Now those aim to solve both the problems I've talked about. They want to tell you what you should be able to derive your opinion from the theory. And also, it should always give you a unique, essentially unique picture of reality. It should give you some explanation of why one measurement of capital occurs, and not other measurements, and not end up with a superposition of measurement of capital. That's kind of full blooded realism. But of course, if you take this approach, you're going to start to have big problems when you try to make a relativistic version of your theory. Okay? Because of Bell's theorem, well, it's not clear how to make it fit compatible with special relativities. And people who work on these theories have a degree that looks themselves even about the best way to do it. Now, I'm not saying it can never be done, maybe it can be done, but it seems not most likely to be successful to do. On the other hand, there's a middle way, okay? And the middle way essentially tries to resolve one of the problems. Doesn't say anything about the other. Okay. So you're a realist in the sense that you want an interpretation in which measurements are not answers and fundamental things. You eliminate talk about measurement from your interpretation. On the other hand, you don't necessarily say which outcome of an experiment is supposed to be answered. Now, the way you do that is kind of by a sneaky trick. And you may suspect, with what I told you about quantum logical realism, that it's maybe an unacceptable trick. But all of these interpretations use some kind of similar sneaky trick. And the sneaky trick is this. You, instead of trying to get rid of measurements, you somehow define the properties of the system at all times using the same kind of formalism that you use for measurements. The projection of ways to play a big role in both existing histories and in quantum logic. In the NRX interpretation, you define it in terms of relative states, and that's how you might choose to define a measurement factor. And all these interpretations do that. In so doing, they don't restore full reality, and thereby making it potentially easier to look at things apart from special relativity. So if I had to place a bet, I'm going to place my money on these interpretations as being the ones which ultimately will be without. That may not be right, but that's what I'm going to do. And of these three, I'm going to go with that one, which I'm Now I'm carrying the quantum logic exception. And the reason for that is, I think it introduces the smallest amount of arbitrary structure into quantum theory. Okay, so that's all this is.
I guess you said that you kind of described the formalism of states in terms of the measure, how you talk about measurement, but it's not exactly clear how that comes out.
Well, it comes out differently in different.
No, but I mean in the course of, so basically what you're saying is that quantum logic is a foundation, and then each of these three would make their decision of what it means for measurements. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they take some aspect of the way measurement works in quantum formalism. Okay? So Everett takes seriously the idea, for instance, that you have a superposition of different measurement outcomes, measurement apparatus, correlated with the different states of the system. And somehow you want to say that one of those outcomes occurs. So one way of doing that is to enforce that as the way you try to prompt it. So that's one way of taking it as a state. Consistent histories and quantum logic do the same trick in a different way. They do it in a very similar way. You then say, the major differences between the two is that consistent histories never allows you to make propositions about incompatible terms. We have this restriction this session here and talk about consistent members of histories. I've never really understood why you should bother to make that restriction at all. It just seems to be the arbitrary. Other than that, the experience of interpretation is just really
similar. In the last lecture, Dr. Hardy talked about what's set up to achieve the variable system theory. When it comes to appropriation and then something is happening to it and then you make the measurement. So that's the kind of stuff you talk about in the legal way, if you have this is just displayed twice for a simple measurement. So.
Yeah, I would call that okay, so it depends. Like, if you say that's it, that's all that exists, okay. Then you want to talk about any being operations. Measurements is coming in as a problem. So I would say there's an operational interpretation. They don't really tell you what's real. They don't specify anything as being corresponding to reality apart from classical things.
I get the living sense from what we thought. It seems like it's just that we are just restricting the way we look at reality, not that we are not that we are cutting off reality like the means.
So there are sort of two ways of feeling. Okay. If you take say Lucas approach and stop there and say that's the way it is, then you're being an operationalist. If you say there could be some reality on the line because we just don't know what it is, it's some axioms that you mustn't know. Then that's fully compatible with being. In fact, it's fully compatible with being different reasonable rules. You just haven't said that it's going to happen.
Are there any other natural applications of the quantum logic formalism?
It's a good question. And that's something that I'm very interested in, because I think that people turn out to be useful in quantum computing. I have some vague ideas about how that will work out, but nothing concrete yet. Well, of course, as I said, the history of the general approach to generalized measurements, all these type of measurement formulas that we have in quantum mechanics at the moment, does derive in large part from people who work on this approach. That's often sort of obscured by the way it's been different. but it still has enough to bridge this to it.
If I understood you right, you imply that this kind of approach is more popular among philosophers and physicists. I don't know if you might say something on why you think that case.
Well, I think the reason is quite simple. I mean, logic is the most useful way of logicism, right? What things about like logic and motivational meaning and things like this, that there's a concerns in philosophers meaning rather than concerns in physicists. Having said that, you know, there are one or two things.
Yeah. I also found it kind of interesting that at the beginning you said something to the effect of those of you who are still sort of orthodox, ancient, although probably not really in this course, whereas at this point, after everyone, a lot of people actually who found that this course is pushing them towards orthodox for you rather than away.
Well, okay. Yeah. Well, I guess you have now full appreciation for the difficulties of all of you. Any other questions?
How do we find realism? Is it just something about natural nature?
Well,
how
do you define realism? That's the scale which we also have questions. There are different fragments of realism. But from a naive physicist point of view, you know, it just means that, you know, there has to be something out there. There has to be some state of reality, some kind of reward for the. And also, like, we should be able to explain why the real classical model appears the way it is in terms of those things. I think that's sort of the behavior of the system.
You guys are measuring something. Measurements. Make it up. Imagine the timeline.
There is some real quantum world that exists out there in the real vision.
Okay, so I guess we can send another.